Hi, I'm Charlie Wynn, reading from the Monday, April 29th edition of the Hartford Courant. This by Daniel Pearson, Executive Director of Educators for Excellence Connecticut. His title, Teacher Layoffs May Only Be the Beginning. With the announcement of teacher layoffs in Hartford, we're facing an unprecedented issue that we've been fighting to avoid for the past 4+ years. We have known since 2020 that the federal COVID relief funding had an expiration date. Additionally, we've known that the issues faced during the COVID-19 pandemic existed long before the introduction of these funds. In the wake of the pandemic and the programs put in place to help students and educators navigate through extreme events, we should be discussing what else we can give students to help them succeed, not what we need to be taking away to save money. Last year, Educators for Excellence fought alongside the Education Justice Now Coalition to secure additional education funding for schools as we reach the fiscal cliff. The funds won last year, however, are only the beginning. The state still needs to take necessary measures to fully fund the ECS formula during the next year's budget session. The School and State Finance Project reports that Hartford Public Schools' largest use of the ESSER II funds was to add 102 additional full-time equivalent teachers and contracted tutoring services for students. However, due to the threat of loss of funds, Hartford Public Schools announced layoffs for over 300 educators and administrators in the district. And not only will these layoffs affect students through class sizes and individualized instruction like high dosage tutoring, it will further perpetuate the teaching shortage we are facing in Connecticut. And with the laid off teachers not returning next school year, the overwhelm and burnout of educators is only going to continue to pile up, leading to more educators ultimately deciding to leave the profession. According to the 2023 Voices from the Classroom survey, 87% of educators believe that the role of the classroom teachers has too many responsibilities to allow it to be as effective as needed. And these responsibilities will increase if we take away support staff from classrooms. The same survey also found that only 14% of educators would recommend the teaching profession to a friend, a family member, or an acquaintance. Connecticut schools have one of the largest racial funding gaps in the country. While the additional $150 million currently up for discussion will not come close to solving all of these problems, it certainly would provide additional stability to staffing and students as budget plans are fleshed out. And it's also no coincidence that with this racial funding gap, high needs school districts like Hartford Public Schools are seemingly hit hardest by budget cuts and staff layoffs, and this is unfair for the hardworking staff of these schools and creates an even more inequitable learning environment for students in these districts. The solution to this funding crisis is not to lay off teachers, but for our state and cities to intervene and invest in students in a meaningful way. For example, tuition billing is not beneficial to students. In Hartford, in particular, tuition billing is pitting students in magnet schools and district schools against one another. We need to stop tuition billing, and the state and city need to intervene with funding instead. Mayors, along with the state legislature and leadership, need to demonstrate what we care most about, starting with Connecticut's youth at the top of the list. Hartford students need the same opportunities as students in neighboring affluent communities. Now, thankfully, HB 5212, which is the bill discussing this $150 million in funding, has moved out of the Connecticut Appropriations Committee, and it's now time for the Connecticut House and Senate to pass this budget and continue making strides toward investing in education, giving students in Connecticut the education they need and they deserve. Also, from today's Hartford Current, this by Ichacha Pradham, the policy and advocacy specialist at Health Equity Solutions. The title, Tackling Medical Debt, A Path to Equity and Health Access. As an international student, there was an unspoken pact among us. If you ever find yourself in need of medical help, do not call an ambulance. Call an Uber. The reason? The fear of getting a medical bill you couldn't pay, even with student health insurance. This apprehension stemmed from the unpredictability of hospital cost and how patients often face unexpected out-of-pocket expenses. Many of us found ourselves hesitating to seek medical attention, opting to delay or altogether skip care. Our reluctance was further fueled by the fuzziness surrounding hospital financial assistance or charity care, free or discounted care, and being unaware of the support that may have been available to alleviate the financial burden. Now, this dread isn't unique to international students. It's a widespread issue that affects communities across the state, especially people of color and those with lower incomes, Black, Indigenous, Latino, Latina, and immigrant populations are disproportionately affected by medical debt due to discrimination in employment and education that affect access to health insurance and or other protections against medical debt, all of which compound existing economic and health inequities. In Connecticut alone, almost 280,000 individuals are unable to pay hefty medical bills, facing financial ruin within a system that prioritizes profit margins over basic well-being. Medical debt is not merely a financial inconvenience, but a systemic issue rooted in disparities of income, wealth, and access to health care. And unlike planned debts, such as mortgages, medical debt often arises unexpectedly from a one-time medical expense like an accident or other medical emergency. Individuals burdened with medical debt face decreased access to credit, increased likelihood of bankruptcy, and the inability to afford basic needs like food or rent. And moreover, they feel compelled to skip needed medical care to avoid incurring additional bills they cannot afford. And what's more troubling is that while the IRS mandates nonprofit hospitals to offer hospital financial assistance, many eligible patients are unaware of these programs. In turn, they face lawsuits or harassment from collection agencies for bills that hospital financial assistance should have covered. In 2020, Connecticut hospitals spent $339 million less on financial assistance and community investments compared to the tax breaks they get as a nonprofit hospital. If they had spent this money on financial assistance, they could have cleared medical debt for 240,612 residents. The lack of accountability in enforcing financial assistance policies complicates the matter. In the past decade, the IRS has not revoked the nonprofit status of any hospital for noncompliance, leaving a regulatory void that states must fill to protect residents from unnecessary medical debt. Now, addressing medical debt needs comprehensive solutions aimed at breaking the cycle that perpetuates it. Connecticut legislators must take action, and so we urge the state and hospitals to work together to ensure that some of the hardest moments in our lives don't also leave us in dire financial straits. Now, how could this be done? Number one, simplify the process for patients to learn about and access hospital financial assistance through streamlined applications and robust notification systems. And two, prevent patients from being sent to collections before screening them for financial assistance, and if they do not qualify, offer a reasonable payment plan. Number three, accept alternative documents for patients to verify their income for eligibility determination. And finally, four, hold hospitals accountable for ensuring fair screening processes and ceasing aggressive bill collection practices. The first week of April, recognized in state statute as Health Equity Week, is Connecticut's annual commitment to eliminating health disparities and creating opportunities for every resident to thrive in good health. This year's theme, Affording Equity, is aimed towards dismantling financial barriers, hindering equitable health outcomes for all residents. As a community, we must confront the systemic injustices perpetuating medical debt and hindering access to health care. Implementing HB 5320 would bring us closer to this goal. Looking back on my time as an international student, I wouldn't have had to compromise my health for financial stability if such support systems had existed. By rallying behind HB 5320, we can forge a path toward a healthcare system where every individual can seek medical care without fear of financial devastation. Let's move over to the New York Times, to the weekly conversation between Gail Collins and Brett Stephens. This week's conversation is titled, Some Concrete Reasons Not to Be Totally Panicked. Gail Collins begins. Brett, I have a feeling we're going to be spending a good amount of time talking about the adventures of Donald Trump. Brett Stephens replies, by adventures, you mean affairs? And Gail says, but just to start with something we're in disagreement about. President Biden has, in my opinion, been doing a great job building his reelection campaign. He's been strong on the environment, on creating jobs, long a gray spot in his record, and on trying to support the rights of working men and women to get decent pay and benefits. Go, Joe, and take it away, Brett. And Brett says, well, to quote the commander-in-chief, for four more years, pause. I take it you heard about this Ron Burgundy-style gaffe in his speech last Wednesday in Washington, where he seemed to read a little too fully from the teleprompter. It wouldn't be a big deal, except that it's a reminder that the things that worried us about the president at the beginning of the year will continue to worry us, like his mental acuity, or an inflation rate that seems stubbornly high, even as the economy seems to be slowing, or younger voters who seem to be moving toward Trump or losing interest in politics altogether, or a border crisis that's shifted from Texas to California and New York but hasn't gone away, or the fact that he keeps telling tall tales about his past, or his repeated refusal to sit down for formal interviews with serious journalists other than Howard Stern, all of which is to ask you to give me some concrete reasons not to be totally panicked. And Gail says, let's see. Americans have better access to affordable health care, with the number of uninsured at an all-time low this year. The number of jobs increased by nearly 15 million during his first 3 years in office. And while he most certainly has not solved the border issue, The overall crime rate is lower. There's been a nearly 12% drop in homicide rates from 2022 to 2023. And Brett says, well, I hope it's enough. It feels a little bit like the Polish cavalry going up against the German blitzkrieg. The cause is righteous, the fight is brave, but the means are wanting. Gail says Biden's got a lot of good things to talk about, although I will admit the talking aspect has not always been his long suit. So, Trump time. He's been having a reasonably good run in his multitudinous court cases. Looks like the Stormy Daniels saga in New York may be the only one decided before the election. Brett says, I'm going out on a limb and predict a hung jury. Of all the cases against him, this one is the weakest. Paying hush money, also known as a non-disclosure agreement, is not a crime. Falsifying business records is almost always a misdemeanor, not a felony. And, as my former colleagues at the Wall Street Journal have pointed out, wasn't it Democrats who used to say when they were defending Bill Clinton in his impeachment that everybody lies about sex? Gail says no matter what happens, it's important for the country to see this picture of the president's much bragged about business career, which in the real world has always been a sloppy, lean on rich friends mess. And Brett says, what really worries me about this case is that if Trump isn't convicted, it's going to turbocharge his campaign. Trump will be able to say with some credibility that the deep state was really out to get him. Gail says, okay, Brett, you've depressed me for the rest of the day. Let's move on to Congress. Can't believe I'm saying this, but Congress has been doing pretty well. For the pathetic body it's been lately, that is. Do you agree, Brett? And Brett says, the government didn't shut down. Mike Johnson worked up the nerve plus the votes to get those crucial foreign aid bills for Ukraine, Israel, and Taiwan passed. Anything else I missed, Gail? And Gail says they did the basics. Gave up on trying to impeach Biden. Had some fairly bipartisan votes. Brett says, dismissed the charges against Alejandro Mayorkas in the Senate after his sham of an impeachment in the House. Gail says, I'd say by current standards, that's pretty good. I'm hoping it's because the Pauls are starting to realize that being functional is the sort of thing a majority of their constituents like. But hey, I forgive you for not wanting to dwell for a long time on Mike Johnson's performance. Let's go someplace I know you're interested in. That happens to be just a few blocks from where I live, Columbia. Brett says, I recently debated a Columbia professor who was politically sympathetic to the protests and suggested that the anti-Semitic rhetoric getting attention in the news media was coming from outside agitators rather than Columbia students themselves. And the next day, I learned that one of the student leaders had commented, Zionists don't deserve to live, and also be grateful that I'm not just going out and murdering Zionists. My question for Columbia is how it became a university that accepts and educates the kind of students who will say something like that and becomes a campus leader in the bargain. Too much Edward said and not enough Jacques Varzon, I'd say. Gail says, I've had sympathy with the protesters as a symbol of students standing up for a committed point of view on a serious national and international issue. Nonviolent demonstrations like sit-ins are particular favorites of mine because they're frankly so boring. And kudos to kids willing to devote days, even weeks of their lives to supporting protest movements by just not going anywhere. But as the media moves in and starts publicizing individual students' comments rather than a general political position, things can get nasty. The anti-Semitic tilt of some of the verbiage at Columbia is a good example of what can happen. And Brett says, I wouldn't really object to the protests if at their heart they were simply objecting to the policies of the Israeli government in Gaza. People can have strong, honest differences of opinions on that subject. My objection is that many of those protesters are objecting to the existence of an entire country and of anyone who's in some way a part of it, including the many Israeli students on campus. The protesters' idealism has curdled into hatred, and their hatred is finding a target in many people who, like me, are Jews. Gail says, your point is definitely important and makes the protest worrisome. But the open debate those protests spark also helps the public appreciate the dangers of some of the dark commentary involving the Israeli crisis. But let's talk spring. It's so definitely spring. Any favorite new books, TV shows, tulip bulbs? Brett says that's a good change of subject. Now, I've been meaning to watch Shogun because I loved the original James Clavell novel when I read it as a kid. I've also been reading New Cold Wars by our colleague Dave Sanger about the Biden administration's efforts to contain and confront Russian and Chinese aggression. David's probably my favorite Times reporter, except for the obit writers, of course, partly because he covers the stories that interest me most, partly because he covers them so well. The book reads like a brilliant thriller about a dystopian near future that happens to be our recent past. And it will also make you feel marginally better about the American government. How about you, Gail? And Gail says, you are definitely our book whisperer. And kudos to David Sanger, of course. Just the author's name on the cover is enough to assure you there's something fine there. Brett says, David didn't even pay us to say that, and I swear to God. Gail says, my job is to go to the opposite end of the cultural continuum, TV. So I recommend The Sympathizer, a new HBO miniseries. It's based on a novel by Viet Thanh Nguyen about a double agent for the Viet Cong who winds up in America. It's neat to have an engrossing piece of entertainment about the war in Vietnam, which nobody talks about anymore. Brett says the Vietnam War is about as distant from us now as World War I was distant to the Vietnam generation. Gail says, yeah, I must admit, if you asked me a World War I question in college, I'd have been totally lost. I knew some of the songs, of course. Anything you're expecting people will remember about our time. I'm presuming that unless there's an even bigger national or international disaster we have to rise up to, there's not going to be much talk about the Biden era. Trump, on the other hand, is someone you hope we're going to be able to forget, but the chances aren't great. And Brett gets the last word, saying, for me, there will be the erosion of democratic norms in the era of Trump. For my kids, it will probably be the pandemic, the way it interrupted their childhoods and left permanent psychic scars on many of their friends. But maybe my grandchildren will remember these years the way we now remember the 1930s or 1850s. It's angry, polarized, depressing years that preceded our finest and most redemptive hours. This time, I pray, without the bloody ordeals that followed. Also from the New York Times, this guest essay by Rebecca Roif, former assistant district attorney in the Manhattan District Attorney's Office. Her title, I was an attorney at the DA's office. This is what the Trump case is really about. Now that the lawyers are laying out their respective theories of the case in the criminal prosecution of Donald Trump in New York, it would be understandable if people's heads are spinning. The defense lawyers claim this is a case about hush money as a legitimate tool in Democratic elections, while the prosecutors insisting it's about a criminal scheme to corrupt the 2016 presidential election. And yet, this case is not really about election interference, nor is it a politically motivated attempt to criminalize a benign personal deal. Boring as it may sound, it is a case about business integrity. It's not surprising that the lawyers on both sides are trying to make this about something sexier. This is a narrative device used to make the jurors and the public side with them, but it has also created confusion. On the one hand, some legal experts claim that the conduct charged in New York was the original election interference. On the other hand, some critics think the criminal case is a witch hunt, and others claim it's trivial at best, and at worst, the product of selective prosecution. Well, as someone who worked in the Manhattan District Attorney's office and enforced the laws that Mr. Trump is accused of violating, I stand firmly in neither camp. It is an important and straightforward case, although workmanlike and unglamorous. In time, after the smoke created by lawyers has cleared, it will be easy to see why the prosecution is both solid and legitimate. It would hardly make for a dramatic opening statement or cable news soundbite, but the case is about preventing wealthy people from using their businesses to commit crimes and hide from accountability. Manhattan prosecutors have long considered it their province to ensure the integrity of the financial markets. As Robert Morgenthau, a former Manhattan district attorney, liked to say, you cannot prosecute crime in the streets without prosecuting crime in the suites. Well, that's it for today's edition of Cross Currents. I'm Charlie Wynn. I've been reading from the editorial and the opinion pages of the New York Times and the Hartford Courant. Thanks for listening. You have a great day.